In 2002, Hannah Kent was a student living in Adelaide, and then she won a place on a Rotary exchange program, and they placed her for a year in Iceland. And we're not talking about downtown Reykjavik here, we're talking about regional Iceland. In fact, it was a small fishing village. Hannah Kent had nothing of the local language, she had never seen snow before, and she didn't much care for fish either, for that matter. She was a bit shy, and so she became incredibly lonely, living in a land where almost nothing was familiar. But the land around the village was spectacular and filled with stories that go back to the time of the Vikings. And in one spot, Hannah heard the story of a woman called Agnes Magnusdottir. This was the place where Agnes had been executed back in 1830. She was the last woman to be executed in Iceland. Agnes was sentenced to death for her part in a double murder, and for that crime she was beheaded with a ceremonial axe. This story lodged itself in Hannah Kent's subconscious, and several years later she went back to Iceland to research every detail of the life and times of Agnes, and Hannah wrote a novel, and it's called Burial Rites, where she imagined herself into the last months of Agnes's life, and she describes this book as her dark love letter to Iceland. Hello, Hannah.
Hello.
What a great yarn. There's two stories today. There's your story and there's Agnes's story in the middle, and we have to start with yours. Describe your life as it was as a schoolgirl in Adelaide before you went on this great adventure.
I had a very normal childhood, I think, if there is such a thing. I grew up in a family with a mother and a father and a little sister, and spent a lot of my childhood running outside, and I was from the Adelaide Hills. We had quite a large few paddocks that I could go in and make cubbies in. I had a very imaginative childhood, but it was very much quite parochial in some way. I didn't do a lot of travel as a kid.
And so you're one of those good kids and you're up for a Rotary exchange program. How did Iceland come to be the destination for you?
It's quite a long story, really. I finished high school and I sort of became quite terrified as my last sort of months of year 12 were drawing to a close about what I would do next. I knew I probably eventually wanted to go to university, but I didn't know whether to settle on a career that was, you know, would get me a lot of, you know, at least financial security, whether I should do teaching or maybe medicine. And the thought also that I would then embark on a career that I might be chained to for the rest of the life basically scared me. I didn't really feel ready to make those sorts of decisions. So basically as a deferral tactic, I decided to apply for a Rotary exchange, which I'd heard about through my high school.
So you had this idea that you needed some kind of formative experience, a vague idea that you kind of reached towards then.
Absolutely. I think I was very keen to have an adventure as I was sort of thinking of it back then, but also at the same time to defer, you know, becoming an adult for as long as I could. So that's what led me to apply for the exchange.
And so they asked you where you would like to go?
They didn't. Rotary is a bit different to some other exchange programs. What they ask you to do is to nominate maybe two or three countries that you'd like to go to or you think you would. But then there's a selection process. And what they do as part of that is interview you and maybe work out where it is that they would like to send you also. And I remember I was sort of in the latter half of this selection process, and I was being interviewed by three Rotarians, you know, in front of a panel. And they were asking me all the very hard questions at this stage of the selection process, you know, how will you deal with the homesickness and how will you go about making new friends and so on. And one of them then asked me, Hannah, you know, how would you react if you were sent to a country where it was dark 24 hours a day? And I think I surprised him with how enthusiastic I was. I remember saying, oh, I think that would be incredibly interesting. It would be like nothing I've experienced before. Absolutely, I'd be up for it. And I remember one of the Rotarians then making a big fat cross next to my name on the piece of paper in front of him. And I think that's probably why, while they sent off, you know, three or four exchange students to the US and to France, I was the lone exchange student to be sent to Iceland.
How did you react when you got that? What, you got something in the mail or a phone call that said, or an email that said, congratulations, young lady, you're going to Iceland?
I know, I got a letter in the mail and it said Iceland, and then it said the town that I was going to be sent to, which was Sauðárkrókur, and I'd never heard of such a place. I'd assumed that if I was going to Iceland, I'd be sent to Reykjavik, the capital in the south, which is where I think any previous exchange student had been sent. And so I immediately got an atlas out of my parents' bookshelf and tried to find this Sauðárkrókur. It looked like soda cracker, and it wasn't even in the atlas, and I'm thinking, goodness me, where are they sending me? Where am I going?
Where is So the Croker?
It's in North Iceland, actually.
So it's not in the temperate zone of Iceland.
No.
It's in the colder part of Iceland.
Absolutely. And it really does look like it's on the edge of the world. I don't think you can get much further north unless you're going to Greenland.
So how did you prepare to go to such a place?
I don't think I did, really. I don't think I had any real idea of what it was that I was letting myself in for. I remember trying to find some good hiking boots because not having experience, I'd never seen snow before, not having experienced any sort of extreme climate other than 40-plus degree heat waves in Adelaide, I thought, well, you probably need some shoes. And I remember, you know, my dad kitted me out with a whole bunch of, you know, layers and some camping gear that we thought might come in useful. But I think, really, I was more concerned actually about leaving home for 12 months and not seeing my family for 12. I didn't actually think about what Iceland itself might well be like. I didn't know anything about the country.
So then you had to travel from a city that's on the edge of the Great Southern Ocean all the way up to the edge of the Arctic Circle, from the bottom of the planet right up to the top. How do you do a trip like that anyway?
Oh, it took a long time. This was 10 years ago, so it took me 2 days. I think I probably had to fly from Adelaide to Sydney to Kuala Lumpur or somewhere like that. And then I remember being in Amsterdam. I remember I had a short break in Amsterdam where a Rotarian came and picked me up and took me on a tour of all the canals. And I was so jet lagged, I kept falling asleep in the boat that he was taking me on. So I don't have a very strong memory. And eventually I arrived in Reykjavik at about 9:45. It was at Keflavik Airport, the main airport of the country. And in fact, I arrived and the Rotarians in Australia had told me that when you arrive at your destination, you need to wear the Rotary jacket, the exchange jacket that they give you, which is, you know, this horrible green colour, and was two sizes too big for me. So I'm standing there, and the reason they ask you to do that is so that you can easily be identified and the people can come pick you up. And so I was standing there after collecting my baggage with this jacket on and all the badges, waiting for the man that I knew would come. And his name was Jon, I remember that. And I was waiting, and all the other passengers sort of dispersed and went onto this bus that was waiting outside the airport, small airport. And no one was coming. And I started to get a bit nervous, and I thought maybe I should give them a call. They'd given me a phone number. So I went to a payphone and put in the numbers and got a whole lot of garbled someone speaking back to me that was obviously Icelandic, but I couldn't understand a word of. But it was pretty clear from the tone that it was the number had been disconnected. And so I started to panic a little bit. You know, I was very tired and quite quite intimidated as well.
And was this late at night, was it, at Reykjavik Airport?
Yeah, this was midnight.
And then, there you are in your Rotarian jacket that's two sizes too big for you, and you're all alone, and there's no one there to pick you up.
No. And then eventually a security woman at the airport came up to me and said something again in Icelandic, and I just shook my head. And she asked me in English, you know, that she basically said, you need to get on the bus. And I said, no, a man's coming to get me. And she said, oh, have you called him? And I said, yes. And she said, well, you probably need to do something soon because we're about to shut the airport. There's no more flights coming till next morning. And I said, well, I tried to call him, but it didn't work. So she took the number and gave it a call and said, no, this number's disconnected. It's the wrong number. And I was thinking, oh, goodness. She said, look, you have to get on this bus, because I didn't even know that Keflavik wasn't the capital. I didn't realise it's a 45-minute bus trip into the actual city. So she basically pushed me onto this bus, took the piece of paper with this man's name and number on it and said, just get on the bus. You have to get on the bus. You can't stay in the airport. So I remember sitting on this bus, looking out the window in just to an expanse of black. I couldn't see anything. There's no real street lights. I mean, there are street lights along this main road leading into this capital, but nothing else. I had no idea where I was, no idea what was going to happen. But luckily, when I did arrive at the final bus terminal, there was a man there who'd obviously just woken up, who are there to greet me. And I think the security woman had finally found him through doing a search through his name, because in Iceland it can be quite easy. You're all listed in the phone book, and she'd managed to finally find the right Jon.
So this is right at midnight or something, or well past one in the morning. And was he in his jammies or something, was he?
No, I think he'd put a shirt on, but his hair was certainly, you know, he'd been sleeping.
And what did he say to you once? This was the guy that was supposed to pick you up. Why wasn't he at the airport?
He forgot. He said, oh, I'm so sorry. I forgot that you were coming tonight. I thought it was next week. And then he put me in his car, and he was a very jovial, very friendly man.
Were you in tears, or were you hanging on all right?
Oh, I think I was so jet lagged from such a long journey. I think I was just I was exhausted, really. I was just grateful to get to a bed that night.
And where did he take you?
He actually took me back to a place where I didn't realise at the time. He was an archivist and he lived in the National Archives. And I didn't realise that this was the first place that I spent my first night in Iceland before I flew up to Suðurkrókur. But when I came back to Iceland, we'll probably get there, but I came back to Iceland some years later to specifically go visit the archives. And I walked up to the front of it and I thought to myself, I know this place. I've been here before. And it was because I spent my very first night in Iceland at the National Archives.
So then you're in Reykjavik. How do you get to this little town of Suðurkrókur from Reykjavik?
Most people drive. It's probably about a 3 to 4 hour drive, depending on the weather, just on the main highway around the country. But they actually sent me in a plane. So the very next day, I got into a tiny, tiny matchbox of a plane. I think there were probably maybe 6 seats in there. And it went right up to the north. And it was quite a scary journey, actually. I've never felt turbulence like I did in that tiny plane, flying over Iceland's strange middle, uninhabited middle. And then we landed in Suðurkrókur, and the airport there is not much more really than a shed with a tiny baggage carousel in the middle of a paddock. And that was night. It was nightfall by the time I arrived there, so I didn't even get to see what Suðurkrókur looked like until the next morning.
So what did it look like when you woke up the next day? What was that like?
Well, I was picked up by my first host family who were there, and they took me back to their house. And again, I was so exhausted from the journey, I fell asleep. And then the next morning I woke up quite late. It was probably about 10:30. And I remember going out into the kitchen and, very shyly greeting my new host mum and sitting down for, a glass of water or something. And I noticed she opened the curtains at about 11 o'clock and it had slowly grown light enough into this strange blue twilight that you have in the winter for a few hours of every day. And I looked out and all of a sudden I could see everything just covered in snow, and directly in front of me was this iron grey fjord coming in. I didn't even know that this town was on the edge of the coast, and this massive mountain looming up by the side of the town as well. And I was gobsmacked. I hadn't realised that I'd be going to a place where there'd be mountains. I'd never seen them before.
Did it make you giddy?
I was so excited to see the snow, that in particular. I'd never seen it before. And after we had breakfast, my host mother asked me if I'd like to go for a walk just to sort of see the town. They were on sort of the hill, and most of the town's houses were a little bit closer to the water around the main street. There's only one main street. And I said, yes, absolutely. And I remember going for a walk up to the high school, which was probably only about, half a K away. Walking on the snow and starting to laugh because I'd never realised that when you walk on fresh snow, it makes a squeaking noise. I just had no idea. So it was a very memorable morning, that's for sure.
There aren't really many trees in Iceland, are there? Were there any trees at all?
None, and I hadn't realised that either. It was and the effect was quite unusual. I'd never realised that without trees you get such an uninterrupted vista of the horizon. And this little town is situated in such a way that not only are you up against the mountain, which is right by on one side of the fjord, but over the sea and over the harbour, which is lined with black sand, not white, you've got the other mountains. And you can see so far into the distance that I think this contributes to this sense that you really are on the edge of the world. And it makes you feel quite present in the landscape as well, because you're not... everyone else can see you. There's nothing to impede their vision. There's no trees. It's just sort of the undulating valley and then the sort of the jagged silhouette of the mountains in front of you.
I think I'd get a bit panicky myself in that kind of to begin with, because you're a city girl. You grew up in Adelaide, a city of 1.2 million people thereabouts, and to go from there to this tiny village so far away from everything. Did that worry you initially, that feeling of being so far away in a tiny little village with only a smattering of people and this kind of terrifying landscape around you?
No, not at the time. I hadn't really thought about it. And I grew up in the Adelaide Hills, which in some ways is quite a small community. I grew up knowing, the people and always bumping into people when you go down to the shops and so forth. So it wasn't so much that concerned me, but the landscape threw me. I'd heard that Iceland was quite different. I knew that it had volcanoes and geysers and hot pools and glaciers, but I had no idea just how stark and hostile and utterly beautiful at the same time it could be.
How welcoming were the people of Suðurkrókur, in all honesty?
In all honesty, it's strange because at the time I felt that my reception, occasionally was hostile, and I now know, looking back, that it's not hostility that prevents Icelanders in these small communities from necessarily going up and introducing themselves to visitors, but more sort of a collective shyness. But there was no mistaking that once I arrived, I was very much the outsider. I was the foreign girl in town.
And how did they make you feel that way?
I think the first way I realised that, I hadn't known that people wouldn't necessarily have heard that I was coming. I thought, obviously, my host family and the Rotary Club will know that I'm there, but the other town would probably be, you know, other town members would be clueless. But I remember walking to school probably only a month or so after I had first arrived, through the snow, in this semi-light, this strange blue twilight that you get in the north. And this car, I was walking along the side of the road, and this, I remember four-wheel drives pulling up next to me, slowing down, and then the windows being rolled down for the passengers inside to get a good look at who I was, you know, this strange Australian girl who everyone suddenly knew was there. And occasionally I'd be introduced to people, and I'd say, oh, my name's Hannah, and I'm from Australia, and they're like, oh, we know. So it was this very strange... It was a very strange feeling of being incredibly conspicuous, which to a fairly shy 17-year-old as I was, made me feel very self-conscious. And yet at the same time, at the high school and sort of around the town, no one would necessarily come up and introduce themselves to me or necessarily engage in conversation. So I felt incredibly socially isolated alongside this feeling of being incredibly conspicuous. And that was very actually quite difficult to deal with.
Were they curious about you? Didn't they want to pepper you with questions about Australia? Since, you know, if an Icelandic person sort of came into the middle of a social situation in Australia, you'd want, oh, man, what's it like? You ask questions, wouldn't you? Was it like that for you? Were you exotic in a way which made them want to ask questions about Australia?
They did. It took some time, though. I think probably because they didn't want to necessarily put themselves out there at first. Again, I don't know quite how to explain it. I remember in the later months of my exchange, by this stage I'd learnt the language and made friends, asking some people why they hadn't come up and introduced themselves as early, you know, as why they took so much time basically to become my friend. And because they had said that they were really interested by the fact that there was this Australian girl there. And they said, oh, we didn't realise, we were just letting you settle in, and, you know, and I think it was more of just once you hang around for long enough, then they feel comfortable with you and then they ask you these questions. And they did. I had quite a few questions about Neighbours, actually, and They get Neighbours. And in fact, one of my schoolmates, I remember in the art class, spoke English very well and had an Australian accent because she'd learned English through watching Neighbours.
Did she have an upward inflection like everyone
Absolutely.
In Neighbours does?
Slightly nasal as well, yeah.
Hannah, go and clean your room. How close did you become to the host families that had you there?
I ended up having three host families. I became very close to my second host family. I moved there probably after about 3 or 4 months. And I think the reason why I became... my other host families were very generous to take me in and were nothing but civil to me. But I think I developed quite a special relationship with my second because they had, when I first arrived there, they had 4 kids under the age of 10. You know, and there was a 1-year-old whose language level was pretty much on par with mine. I mean, kids are a great way to break the ice, and they would ask me questions and they would prattle away to me in Icelandic whether or not I understood them, and they would play games with me. So I felt much more included immediately.
And that's how you picked up some language?
That's how I started. The other way, I think, I ended up learning Icelandic. It's quite a strange way to pick up a foreign language. My first host father, he was, I think, quite concerned at how shy I was because I became quite withdrawn, probably as a combination of not knowing how to deal with these feelings of being an outsider and also homesickness. And I remember one night he said, come on, Hannah, you know, get in the car. And he took me down to the sort of the industrial pocket of the town and dropped me off in front of a warehouse and said, follow me up the stairs. And I had no idea where I was going. And I followed him up the stairs, and there's this old building filled with people, probably about 10 to 15 people. And he said, oh, this is Hannah. She's an exchange student. I heard that she likes acting. So here you go, Hannah, this is the local theatre group. Come and join. And I sort of was there, and, you know, they were very friendly there. One woman, I remember, came up to me and said, oh, do you speak Icelandic? No, that's fine. Take a seat. We're putting on this play. It's great that you'd like to be involved. I had no idea. It's great that you'd like to be involved, and we'll find something for you to do. And they were very welcoming, actually. And eventually what they got me to do is, because I didn't speak Icelandic, I obviously couldn't act. So they thought that I could be the props girl. So I'd be behind the scenes organising all these different props and doing certain cues and so forth. And I agreed to it because it seemed really straightforward. What I didn't realise is that the play that they eventually put on was one that was actually quite violent, and it needed a lot of special effects, so gunshots and arrows being flicked as though they're being shot on stage and all these sorts of things that needed to be timed quite carefully. And it was my responsibility, you know, to let off the fake gun. So,
But you need to know the cue. You need to know Icelandic to know what they're saying in order to fire the gun, don't you?
That's what I realised. And the other thing is that I needed to be able to, you know, hear the language, because I could probably memorise certain lines, but also be able to see what it looked like on the page. And that's how I learnt Icelandic.
Were there any thermal pools nearby? Because, you know, we hear these stories in Iceland. It's so volcanically active, and there are all these, you know, hot springs and thermal pools. Were there any nearby this village?
There was, actually, and I got to go there quite early on in my exchange. There's a pool called Grettislaug, or Grettir's Pool, and it's right, if you drive out of the town straight towards the edge of the mountain alongside this fjord, you reach this tiny little hot pool. And legend has it that there's two islands that sit out a little distance into this fjord. They're called Drangi and Malmi. And the legend has it that the outlaw, Grettir, he lived on these islands. He was banished there for all sorts of misdeeds. But being an outlaw, he didn't like being told what to do. And one time he decided to go back to the mainland. So he swam. He swam the length of the fjord and arrived at the mainland. And the point where he arrived is at the end of this mountain, where this hot spring is, this Grettislaug. And legend, or the sagas, say that he hopped into this hot spring to revive himself after the, you know, such low temperatures of the ocean. And that's how he was able to sort of go on with his journey and with his saga. And it's still there to this day. You can still go and bathe in Grettislaug.
And did you? Did you bathe there?
Many times.
And is it one of those ones where you actually wear a bathing suit of some kind, or are you all scando and very naked as you do all this kind of thing?
Well, when I first went, it was with my host family, so I did wear some bathers. But I remember it was a very popular destination for teenagers of the town during the summer when you have the midnight sun, because if you drive right out to the end, it's just a dirt road, drive out right to the end of this mountain, you can actually see the midnight sun, which turns this crimson as it sets, just go down in a semicircle until it brushes the lip of the sea and then starts its way back up again. And so people would drive out there to basically get drunk and watch the sun do its little circle above the sea. And they would bathe in Grettislaug. And probably because of the alcohol involved, there was a fair bit of nudity as well and running around the paddocks.
Are they pretty sulfuric, these? Do they have that kind of sulfuric, you know, rotten eggs type thing going on in them as well, in these thermal pools?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, it's not even so much the thermal pools. I really noticed it when I had a shower in Iceland, because most of their, or pretty much all of their hot water is generated from all the geothermal activity that they have. And in fact, in Sauðárkrókur, the town where I was, the water comes through these pipes, and the processing plant for this water, before it gets to the town, is to do nothing but to cool it down, because it's so hot it would basically scald you if it came out of your shower head. So what they do is take it through to this processing plant, cool it down, and then send it through to the rest of the town for all the domestic use, but also to heat the roads underneath, so to clear snow in the winter, which is fantastic. You know, it's a wonderfully renewable energy source, and with, you know, almost zero emissions. But the downside is that you do tend to have a shower that stinks of nothing but rotten eggs. So it took me a good few weeks before I could start actually feeling clean with this smell.
Was there a great big voice screaming in your head going, I want to go back to Adelaide?
No, I probably at some point when I was homesick. But there's something that's also incredibly compelling about Iceland. And I knew, as miserable as I did get in those first few months, I wanted to see it out. I wanted to see what, I guess, the summer looked like as well.
I've lived through a couple of English winters, and, you know, in London, where, you know, the sun sort of half-heartedly creeps up into the sky around about 10 o'clock in the morning and then sort of just goes, oh, and goes back to sleep at 3. I just wonder what that's like in Iceland, where you have even fewer daylight hours. Mm. And did it play with your mind a bit after a while?
Absolutely. The first winter, it was hard. I don't think I realised that the weather was, the darkness particularly, was having this impact on me, because I thought it was just homesick. I knew I felt sad and upset, and I assumed that that's what it was. But because I stayed the full year, I also experienced winter at the other end, once I had learned Icelandic, once I had friends and connections and felt part of this community. And what I found myself doing was something that many people in Iceland do, which is you keep yourself busy. You don't sort of sit there, because you can't go outside. The weather's so bad. So instead of sitting there and watching television or doing things like that, people get quite creative and they get quite active and social. And I joined what they call a sewing club, where there's not much sewing going on. It's probably just a little social club where I met with a few other young women, and often you would knit or you would crochet. And it was strange. I think it's become, you know, knitting and so forth, it's become quite popular in recent years, a sort of a granny chic thing here in Australia. But in Iceland, it's just what they do. So they'll be there, you know, moaning about their boyfriends, drinking a beer and, you know, knitting a baby blanket or something. It was quite extraordinary.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio, on air, online and on digital. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
I'm with Hannah Kent today. Hannah, at the age of 17, we got a place on a Rotary exchange program in Iceland, where she lived in a small fishing village for a year. And from that time, she heard a story about a woman called Agnes Magnusdottir, who was the last woman to be executed in Iceland. This has formed the basis of her first novel, which is called Burial Rites. We'll come to that in just a moment. I do have to ask you, before we get to Agnes's story, about how you adjusted to the local food. What is the local food in a place like Iceland, where I'm guessing there aren't too many market gardens around the place?
No, not too many market gardens, although I hear these days they have a lot of greenhouses, which means they can produce a lot of their own fresh produce. But back when I was there, particularly probably because I was in a fairly rural area, there was a lot of meat, a lot of lamb particularly, and a lot of fish. And other than that, a lot of dairy, probably not so many fresh fruit and vegetables. In fact, there were two local stores in this town, and there still are, in fact, and they would have their shipments of fresh fruit and vegetable every Wednesday and Saturday. So coming from the Adelaide Hills, you know, which is basically a fruit basket, I soon started to really miss that beautiful fresh produce. And so as soon as I learned when these new shipments of fresh food were coming into the stores, I'd go down there on a Wednesday. My host families didn't buy a great deal of fresh fruit and veg. So I'd go down on a Wednesday with my pocket money, and I remember one day I went there and I found this big bag of delicious-looking apples from California. It was all imported. And I thought, oh, this is brilliant. Normally the apples there were these little wizened things, you know, stuff that would never even get on the shelf in the Adelaide Hills. And there was this great big bag, so I thought, oh, brilliant, I'll treat myself. So I bought the bag of apples and took them back to my room and took a big bite, and it was just flour inside. And I thought, that's okay, I've got a bag of them. I went through every single apple in that bag, and I couldn't find that I could eat any of them. It was very disappointing. But on the other hand, the dairy is amazing. They have all these sorts of different kinds of milk, from sour milk to, oh, there's the most delicious food stuff called skyr, which tastes and has this consistency of yogurt, or, you know, quite a firm set Greek yogurt, something like that, but is in fact a fresh cheese. And it's fantastic for you. It's so low in calories. It's like a wonder food. And I still crave it to this day, but you can't find any in Australia because you need skyr to make skyr. So it's often the first thing I'll do whenever I go back to Iceland is try and find a supermarket and get a few tubs.
Anything you couldn't manage to eat from the local food?
There's a time where you eat thormat, which is sort of the traditional foods that you tend to eat in February. And I remember being with my first host family and coming out to the living room, and they'd put out a spread of what basically looked like different kinds of pet food to my eyes. There was blood sausage, which I'd never tried before. There was another kind of sausage which looked like all the sorts of bits of meat and animal that you shouldn't be eating, compressed in a kind of a jelly. There were sheep's testicles in a clear jelly. There was sin sheep's head. There was harfiskur, or hard fish, which is dried fish covered in lots of butter. Whale blubber I tried, which sort of has the consistency of lipstick. If you were to eat a lipstick, that's kind of how it tasted. And I tried all of these foods, and I managed to actually keep most of them down. And in fact, as disgusting as some of them looked, I actually quite enjoyed quite a bit of it. But there was one thing that I just could not handle while I was there. I could not keep it down. And this was something called haukatl, and it's essentially rotten shark. The shark, when it's caught, as I hear, is quite poisonous. So to leach the poison from the flesh and to make it edible, they essentially let it ferment or rot, and then they can eat it. And it's said to be a bit of a delicacy, like some, you know, very, very strong, mouldy cheeses. And I remember it smelt so bad, I thought, I can't eat this. I cannot do it. I'm going to vomit all over the kitchen table. But I did. They cut me this tiny little piece, no bigger than probably a square centimetre. And I put it in my mouth and immediately had to run from the table, knocking over my chair in the process, to the bathroom, where I remember I, rather than spitting it into the toilet or sink or something, I spat it into the little bin that they had in there, and consequently forgot all about it in, you know, an effort to wash my mouth out. And then some days later, this horrific stench could be smelt in the house. And they thought that there must have been something that had died, or, you know, the dog had done something, you know, untoward in a corner. And I remember cleaning the house with them. We're trying to find the source of this stench. And, of course, it turned out to be this tiny, tiny little piece of rotten shark. So I still couldn't eat that. You couldn't pay me to eat that again.
It's one of those places, Iceland, as you say, and Carrie Gislason is an Icelandic-Australian author who's been on the program, has told me this before. There's so much of the land in Iceland. There's so many stories about it. And it was like that for you too. Tell me about the place where you first heard the story of this woman, Agnes Magnusdottir.
It was in the first few months. I remember I was with my first host family, and we were driving up the main road in Iceland, the Highway 1 Ring Road. And we came to this, we were in the north, returning from a journey in Reykjavik, and we came to this area, this valley called Vatsdalur, where there's mountains and then this sort of broad sweeping land, some of it pastoral, some of it more or less, you know, just left, all of it bare and without trees. And then you get to this valley mouth, which suddenly erupts into hundreds of small hillocks. It looks like they're not big enough to be hills, so hill is the wrong word. It's like the earth suddenly has a whole series of pimples. It just erupts in these small hills. And I asked my host family, I had seen a documentary about Vikings, and to me they look like the small Viking burial mounds that you see. And I asked them if that's what they were. And they said, no, actually, you know, I think it was an avalanche which had caused them some many years ago. But since you ask about this place, it is significant, but for a very different reason. And they pointed to three hills that were nestled quite closely together by the side of the road. And they said that those three hills are called Þristapár, and that is where the last execution occurred in Iceland. And I was, you know, immediately curious, as you are when you hear these sorts of stories, and I asked them what happened. And I remember my host mother telling me that it was a woman, and that she had been executed by broadaxe for her role in the murder of two men and the arson attack that attempted to hide the evidence, basically. And that was all they could really tell me at that time. But I remember being so struck, I think, with both the idea that it was a woman who was beheaded, and also the fact that it seemed like such a grisly crime in a country where crime is relatively rare.
Yeah, what were you told about the crime?
I asked, they couldn't tell me much more about it, but for reasons that I didn't really, you know, give much thought to at the time, I became very intensely curious about this story and continued to ask questions. And I eventually learnt, after probably doing a bit of reading and research on my own accord as well, that the crime is more or less understood as basically on the early hours of the 14th of March in 1828, a northern farm called Stapakoti, the people at this farm were woken up by Agnes Magnusdottir, a local servant woman from the neighbouring farm, Lugastadir, still at some distance away, but still a neighbouring farm. And she was knocking on the door, and when they woke up and went out to her, she said that Lugastadir, the farm where she lived and worked, was stood in bright flames. That was her translation. It stood in bright flames, and that her master, the farmer of Lugastadir, Nathan Kettleson, and another guest for the night, a man called Pjotr Jönsson, were trapped inside. And so this family at Stapakoti went with Agnes back along the rocky shore of this Vatsnes Peninsula where it occurred, this very isolated region. And they arrived at Lugastadir, and the farm indeed was burning down. Keeping in mind, though, that it was a turf farm. These are houses built of turf. It wasn't necessarily burning like a house of wood might. And so they were actually able to extinguish the fire. And eventually they were also able to go inside and find the bodies of indeed dead men.
It's two dead farmers.
Two dead men. One was the farmer, and the other was more just a guest of his for the night, who actually turned out to be sort of a local petty thief. And it was basically thought to be just a general tragedy. Agnes said that a fire had spread from the kitchen to the Badstofa, which was the living area of these turf homes, and they had perished. But then one of the farmers at Stapakoti, as soon as it grew light enough, given that this was in March, it took some time, he went over and examined the bodies, and he saw what he thought were stab wounds, and he also saw what he thought was blood on remnants of unburnt clothing. And he became suspicious that it wasn't exactly as Agnes and Sigga, the other female servant who worked at a Lugerstar there, were saying.
So it seemed that they'd been murdered before the farm had been set alight.
That's what he thought. That's what he thought, because of these particular wounds. And one of the men's arms, Nathan's arm, in fact, seemed broken. And so this was all reported to Bjørn Blundell, who was the district commissioner, so the local district authority. He also acted as a magistrate. And from there, Agnes and Sigga, the other servant, were interviewed.
Why did Agnes fall under suspicion, given that she was the one to raise the alarm about the fire?
I think it was eventually realised that three people had been involved in some way in these murders, and they were established as murders. It was realised that Agnes and Sigga knew something of the events, I think probably because their testimonies didn't add up. Sigga also purportedly, according to local history, she was very young, she was only 15 or 16, whereas Agnes was in her early 30s. Confessed that, you know, something bad had happened, and eventually both women named another young man who was probably 17 at the time, a young man called Fridrik Sigurdsson, who was a local farmer's son, and he was questioned, and he denied committing the murders for a very long time, in fact, but eventually after speaking to his local priest, he confessed, and all three were tried, and actually all three were also condemned to death together. It was thought that they'd been a gang. I think the reason, though, what happened was that despite all three were basically given the same sentence and all three were convicted, it was Agnes who seemed to be the one who was unequivocally condemned by that local community as the orchestrator of the attack.
Why? What was it about her? What do we know about her that a quote-unquote servant girl should be singled out like that as the mastermind of this double murder?
Well, this is what made me curious, because she was often spoken of in terms of, she was often represented as quite an unequivocal stereotype. She seemed to me to be often thought of as kind of a Nordic Lady Macbeth, you know, rubbing her hands together in glee. Exactly, you know, plotting these horrible deeds. You know, she seemed unequivocally evil. And to me, I didn't know, first of all, I didn't know why that was. And also to me, it seemed inaccurate. I don't think anyone's that, you know, enough of that sort of stereotype. I tried to find something of her early life in these records of the murder, and I couldn't find it. And I tried to find some sort of ambiguous representation of her character, and I couldn't find that either. In fact, I remember finding a play which had been written about the murders, and there are lines for directions for the actors within this script, and Agnes is, you know, the actress playing Agnes is told in this particular play to laugh devilishly and to rub her hands together and to give a cackle. You know, it's not like it would be.
No, it's not. So the contemporary accounts of her were as this scheming, intelligent. Yeah, so much of Roman history is kind of spurious because there are references to these scheming, wicked women, which people just don't believe it anymore, because there seems to be written with an eye to, I don't know, to slander the person involved. What could you make of all of that, looking at these accounts of this Lady Macbeth, who was a servant girl?
It led me to want to do more research, and the research was very revealing in that I did realise that this idea of Agnes as this Lady Macbeth, as this monster, was perpetuated over time. And I also realised that while Sigga was also given the same death sentence, it was later commuted to a life sentence in Copenhagen, and people seemed to feel sorry for her because she was young, but she was also thought to be not particularly bright. And I think it was easy, this is obviously quite my personal opinion, but I think it was easy, as it is even to this day, to assume that a young woman can commit bad things when she's under the sway of older people.
She was the thrall, and there's a good Viking word, the thrall of this older woman.
Absolutely, Agnes. And then there's also the Fridrik, who is quite well recorded as being a bit of a local thug. So you've got this stupid sort of farm boy who throws his fists around and has got himself into a bit of hot water. But then you have Agnes, who is unmarried, a servant, and yet people know that she was very, very intelligent and very ambitious. She was illegitimate, which probably right from the very start would have set her particular challenges at that time. And I don't think she fitted into any easy understanding of what a woman should be or acceptable female behaviour. She was documented as having a very sharp tongue, so she obviously wasn't afraid of speaking her own opinions. And yet at the same time, she wasn't a mother, so that also didn't seem to make her an acceptable, you know, she couldn't be pigeonholed, basically. And I think people didn't know what to do with that, and it also made them think it was quite easy to assume guilt on her part.
Well, there was a commission of inquiry from the district commissioner. What did they present as her motive for these murders? Was a motive presented?
Yes. Money is often, you know, in terms of the documents that you come across, it's thought that the three, Nathan, the farmer, was quite wealthy. He was a herbalist and a quack doctor, and also a very well-known poet, and he's quite famous for always having money. And in fact, there were rumours that he was a sorcerer because he always had money on hand. He was also thought to occasionally be a thief at one step removal. He used to purportedly hire people to go and steal stock for him and so forth. So it was known that he had a lot of money, and it was thought that the three had conspired together to steal that money. But there's often other, especially in local histories, a motive that gets bandied about, which is that Nathan and Agnes had an affair. And this is supported by some other things, such as some poems between Agnes and another quite famous woman, a woman called Poet Rosa, who was a very famous poet at that time, who had also had a very famous affair with Nathan. And it's thought that Nathan broke up with Rosa, who was married, to have this affair with Agnes, and that eventually he had tired of Agnes, and that Agnes was, you know, the woman scorned, hell-bent on revenge.
Do you think that's likely?
I think it's likely that they had a relationship. But something that really struck me as the more I found out about the crime and how it was executed, and the more I read about the way Agnes was, you know, the fact that she was so bright, and it's commented on right through. You look through it at her confirmation record when she was 13, and it says that she's the only child out of this small group who were confirmed that day, who could read as well as, you know, an adult. And the crime itself is very, very stupid. You know, these men were stabbed in their beds, and then it was sort of a hasty fire was set at a time where things would have been quite damp, and it didn't burn the evidence like it was intended to. It seemed a very foolish, hastily planned crime, and yet here you had a very intelligent woman who surely, if she was, you know, intent on killing someone, would have gone about it in a more intelligent way. And this is something that sat quite uneasily with me, and that's what led me to go back to Iceland and really look at Agnes's life and think, how did she end up in this situation? What other factors were there?
Normally, under these situations at that time, you discovered that people accused or found guilty of such a crime would be sent to Denmark, which I think was the kind of governing power of Iceland at the time. So they would have been taken to Copenhagen and executed there. Why was Agnes and the other guys held on Iceland instead and executed in Iceland?
Officially, the reason is money. It was economically more viable to keep them in custody on local farms in the same district that the crime occurred, and to kill them there, basically, around the place where the original crime occurred. And there's certainly a factor in that. However, there's often, the more you read about the crime and the more you read local histories of the area, it becomes very apparent that there was another motive, particularly by Bjørn Bløndal, to kill them locally. And that was that the district had in recent years sort of gone to the dogs a little bit. There was a lot of petty crime, a lot of theft of stock, so sheep basically, a lot of sheep stealing.
He was setting an example then, was he?
Exactly. And that, I think, is also reflective in the fact that he ordered certain farmers to stand there. The execution wasn't like those we might see recreated in, say, London, where everyone's jeering and throwing fruit and cheers the people were hanged. It wasn't like that at all. It was a very solemn, very formal occasion. The farmers of the district were ordered to go and stand in three distinct rings around the chopping block, and they were also ordered by Bjørn Bløndal not to look away. He also asked local priests of the area and local district officers to make sure that certain men who had a reputation for maybe engaging in illegal activities like theft to attend. So it was very much a way that he could very publicly, I guess,
make the law,
exactly,
the law, presence of the law known,
exactly,
to all the people in the village. Where was she held in Iceland before her execution?
She was originally held at a farm called Storaborg, which is on the same peninsula that Illugastar there, the farm that was burnt down, is. And then she was moved to Kornsal, which is a farm in the Vatsdala Valley, not a great distance away, but certainly at some remove. And she stayed there with a district officer. That's probably why she was sent there. This was another.
Was she imprisoned
authority.
In there on this farm? Was she held in captive in a room or something on this farm, like a jail cell?
Ostensibly, but there were no jail cells. You know, these are tiny, tiny little houses constructed out of, you know, imported wood or driftwood and turf. So I think it would have been very, very difficult to actually keep someone chained up. And in fact, I think one of the incentives for this family to actually hold her in custody there was that they would have an extra pair of hands for work. And the other thing to consider as well is that, where do you run away to?
Yeah.
You know, there's nowhere to go. Even if in the summer, do you run away to sort of the wild lands in the centre of Iceland? Because you're not going to last long there. How are you going to make your living? And it's such a small community. People will know who you are.
The sentence was that she should be executed by beheading. How was she to be beheaded?
She was to... They actually had to import the chopping block because there's no wood in Iceland of that size that they needed. And they also had the axe specifically made. And something that also actually makes me think that it was the intent of Björn Blöndal, the district commissioner, to make the executions an example to the rest of the community, was that he hired Nathan, the dead man's brother, Guðmundur Ketilsson, to perform the executions. And he paid them rather handsomely to do that. And
the brother of the murder victim?
The brother of the murder victim.
Carried out the execution?
Yes.
With an axe?
Mm-hmm.
One that was made especially for the purpose?
Yes, imported.
And imported. That's extraordinary.
Isn't it? It's not quite by the book. So it does make you think, why would you approach... I mean, Guðmundur, historically, and again, in the local accounts of this, was very reluctant to do so. And in fact, even the money that he received for these executions, he gave away because he felt it was blood money.
You mentioned there that certain senior villagers, and I think they were all men, were brought to the execution site to witness it. What do you know of what happened on that day of Agnes's execution?
There's the official account, which is a very dry sort of bureaucratic document, as you might expect, which says that the condemned were led to their fates with dignity and they were very accepting of their fates and everything was carried out as it should be. And afterwards, a short speech was given by so-and-so priest and then everyone went home. And then you also have local accounts. And it's interesting, the more I read about it and the more I spoke to people who, say, had Icelanders who had relatives who were there or who heard about it, the more you realise that everything more or less went out as was planned. Fridrik walked out to the execution block and people, it's tended to believe, it's believed now that he had accepted his fate. He'd become very religious in the time between his sentence and his execution. He led the crowd in a prayer, in a hymn, and also asked them to repeat it. This is all local history that says this. And then he was quite peaceable, actually, about his death. Agnes, however, is another story. Again, you don't find this in the local or the proper official documents, and for good reason. It's thought that she found it very difficult to walk out there, that she was in some ways dragged to the execution block, that she fainted on the way. They didn't know whether she was actually conscious or not by the time that they killed her, and also that she by no means was content, as they said, to walk out towards her fate. She struggled and she was overcome. It's a very different picture painted by local stories than it is in the official documents.
Is it known that whether she'd witnessed Fredrik losing his head?
No, she didn't. There was an official letter that was sent from Copenhagen which detailed in, you know, quite a lot of detail, in fact, very, very specifically, how high the execution platform should be and where Agnes should be while Fredrik was being killed. And it was said that she must be kept out of view, and that's what happened. But, I mean, she knew what was going on.
So it seems very likely she was taken to her death in perfect terror.
Absolutely.
Once the axe came down on her head, what was done with her head?
They were put on stakes. It was ordered that the body should be buried like dogs, basically, in untreated wood at the site of the murder with no marker, and that the heads should be put on stakes. And in fact, I came across a story which said that the heads were accidentally buried with the bodies, and then they realised what they'd done and had to unbury them and then put them on stakes again. It seemed very barbaric for the time, actually. And this is what happened. The bodies were buried at the site of execution without any marker. So over time, people forgot where it was they were buried and the heads were on stakes. But over that night, again, you don't see this in the official documents, but it said that a local farmer's wife thought it was horrible, basically, what they were doing and objected and stole out under the cover of night to steal the heads, and they were never found. They were taken.
I think it's so interesting that you heard one story from the official accounts, which says everything was spick and span and tidied away neatly. And then there's this oral tradition that goes from an event that happened 110 years ago or thereabouts, and that still lives on today, that tells you a very different story. It seems to be like, to me, that there's a lot of fussiness about the account of how it was to be done in a certain way from the officials, that it had to be all done in a certain way. I wonder if that's kind of to disguise the kind of horror that's really at the centre of this act of lopping a woman's head off with an axe.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a way, I think, I mean, I'm very much against the death penalty, but you see it in the way that these sorts of deaths, these sanctioned deaths, are carried out even in the US. You know, it's almost, if we make this such a bureaucratic official process, we leech it of its humanity, and we treat it just like a task that must be done, that it's in some way easier, it's in some way that you can make it acceptable, but it never is. I think for anything, me particularly, with this reading records, both local histories and the official records of this crime, it just makes you realise that you can't trust either, really.
It seems like you have the very strong suspicion that an innocent woman was killed to make a point.
No, and I don't actually think she was innocent, but I think that the way that the execution was carried out was definitely to make a point, and that there were things that were unnecessary that they did to make it so.
Hannah, it's been amazing to hear this story and your story as well, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.